deconstructing psyops, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pella Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neroth-Taylor Show on this Wednesday afternoon. We've got four great guests. We've got Jefferson Morley, who's a top JFK and Nixon expert, and we'll tie the two together, more of which later. We think of Watergate as being a brave journalistic effort against a crooked and bad president. Justice and truth prevailed. But was it actually a deep state political assassination, a sort of softer version of the real assassination of Kennedy a decade earlier? Jefferson Morley is one of the top Kennedy and Watergate writers, and he will tell us whether that's so. Our second guest is also on the CIA trail, Trevor Fitzgibbon, who's worked on the Julian Assange case and who works with truth tellers and whistleblowers. He's going to give us the latest developments on Assange, if he's going to America or not, to be extradited. And he's going to highlight a case in which he's been involved, in which American journalists and lawyers have got together and sued the CIA for unlawful surveillance when they visited Julian Assange, the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Our third guest is well-known on these parts of the world. It's Lembit Opik, friend, a politician, journalist, and esteemed TNT host who's going to talk about current events related to, I think, the Russian seizure of Russian assets. But we're also going to talk about our favorite common topic, which I think is Estonia and the Great Game, as Britain tries to extend its influence in Central Asia, as it did in the Baltic region a generation ago. Finally, we've got Ben Rubenstein, who's an American geopolitical analyst, who's going to talk to us about the Palestine-Israel issue and how it's spread to the American campuses. Cue Woodstock Festival music, Fortunate Son. Has America got its great generational cause and a sort of anti-war, anti-genocide movement? Will the cops go full Kent State on the protesters who have blocked up apparently Columbia, and I think Yale have stopped teaching classes, and the police have already been called in? Exciting stuff. But before we go to those issues, we're just going to talk a little bit about Watergate and the deep state. What it's really about, I think, and Jefferson Morley and I are going to talk about, is whether, to what extent, the deep state took down Nixon. And deep state, of course, is in the news again for those of us who are aficionados of these things, with the arrest in Dresden of a German national suspected of carrying out acts of espionage for China, taking the tally of alleged Chinese spies arrested in Europe in recent days to six. So six people have been arrested. And this coincides with the return to Europe of German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. He'd just been to Beijing and glad-handed the leaders there. And it was all reset and smiles and good relations with Europe and China, these two great trading partners. But on his return, we're now seeing the crackdown on the Chinese spies. Is it this eternal sort of back and forth between the elected politicians who are supposed to serve us and the securocrats who are serving, well, at least they're serving themselves, but who are always escalating and seeking conflict, or is there a good reason for it? We're talking about this, of course, because Jefferson Morley is going to talk about Watergate. Now, I've been writing about this. It brings us back to the early 1970s. We've got Nixon, who's just declared, has got a detente policy going with the Russians and the Chinese. He's sending Kissinger on secret trips to Beijing and Moscow. And this neither CIA or Pentagon could really trust Kissinger, who was this Central European Jew with a gravelly accent. And of course, Christopher Hitchens and many other people have polluted Kissinger's reputation as a sort of a murderer of many Cambodians or whatever. But in one reading of the narrative, he was actually a bit of a political realist who sought détente with America's adversaries and successfully achieved those. Well, we know that the Pentagon had secret tabs on Kissinger. And the question is this, whether the CIA had also sent in their people into the Nixon White House to find out what Nixon was doing and keep tabs on him in the way that the CIA have always infiltrated terrorist movements. That is, they use the terrorist movements to find out what's going on inside the terrorist movement and finally to steer them in a direction that's favorable to them if needs to be. And the official narrative of Watergate is very much a sort of chest-beating discussion about how these brave senators and intelligent journalists were holding Nixon to account over what in retrospect I regard as actually a bit trivial, which is an obstruction of justice. Just a couple of phrases he was involved with in saying, which was he stupidly taped every conversation he had. He didn't need to do this to himself, so he implicated himself. But this was seized upon when he said, well, maybe a la Trump, don't investigate these things. But he was not actually involved in the original Watergate breakings. But anyway, the whole Watergate trial stuff, which was the mainstream daytime television and had senators asking tough questions, that's been used to sort of cover up for the fact that the Watergate break-in itself hasn't been nearly enough looked at until recent years. And Jefferson Morley's done that. And we find out that several of the burglars had four or five of them had CIA backgrounds. And so one of them, he was currently employed by the CIA. And more extraordinarily, which I want to talk about, because I've been researching and I'm going to put out a book quite soon on Watergate and Nixon and Kennedy, is that Howard Hunt, who was the kind of organizer of this Watergate break-in, was one of the lead suspects for the Kennedy assassination 10 years earlier. Isn't that extraordinary? Howard Hunt. Anyway, we've been following this issue. We had James Rosen on a few days ago. He's one of the top White House correspondents in America, and he sort of thinks this is kind of true, but we'll get more about that very shortly. But we're going to go into the day's news with Basil Valentine, our political editor, after a very quick break. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Be a part of the conversation.
I want representation I can trust.
Have your say.
Biden isn't doing enough.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, Basil. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Pelly. Great to be with you. And hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
What is going on? It's another non-eventful day, I guess.
It's all going on, as they say. All going off. We like to keep an eye on those politicians, as we know. Rishi Sunak, who won't be in the job of Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland much longer, I hasten to add, is in Germany, where he has stood shoulder to shoulder in the usual photo op with Chancellor Olaf Scholz, with the European Union, British and German flags behind them, of course. Sunak said that the UK and Germany will provide unwavering support for Ukraine for as long as it takes, as he visited Berlin to deepen defence and security ties. The Prime Minister said every country has got different things that it can bring to the table, after the Chancellor Scholz said his decision not to deliver Taurus cruise missiles to Kiev will not change. So I suppose that's the one sort of little shard of light and good news. Scholz has refused to send the missiles to Ukraine for fear of a wider escalation of the war or even drawing Germany into direct conflict with Russia itself. Sunak, for his part, praised Scholz's recent commitment of another Patriot missile system to bolster Ukraine's air defense, which he called one of Kiev's key needs. Britain, of course, has committed in the last day or two to increasing defence expenditure to 2.5% of GDP. And I would like to contrast that, and indeed Sunak's words about how we face an axis of authoritarian regimes, which is why apparently we need to spend all these billions on military hardware. I'd like to contrast that with Amnesty International's report published just today, which accuses the United Kingdom of deliberately destabilizing human rights globally for its own political ends. So that's quite a circle that has to be squared there, isn't it, Pelly?
Are they more specific about where the UK destabilizes things?
Sasha Deshmukh, Amnesty International UK's chief executive, said, and I quote, "The UK is deliberately destabilizing the entire concept of universal human rights through its appalling domestic policies and politicking." The damning report also criticizes Israel's allies for their failure to stop the indescribable civilian bloodshed in Gaza, in which we are, of course, not only complicit, but willing accomplices. in a stark warning to world. Go on.
Are you saying that, because Amnesty is usually pretty aligned with the Anglo powers, you know, are you saying their UK branch is criticizing the UK for not for human rights? Have I just missed that, or is it Israel they're accusing?
No, you're absolutely right. They're accusing the UK directly.
Yeah. Well, so what domestic policies are they doing that's so bad for Amnesty?
Well, you know, surveillance, cracking down on protests. Right. You know, there's a whole litany, really. In a stark warning to work. Go on.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's incredibly interesting because Amnesty, there used to be sort of revolving doors between Amnesty and the US State Department. And there was a woman who ran it who was very close to Hillary Clinton and Samantha Power. And they were kind of good friends. And basically, Amnesty was really well aligned with anything, the sort of responsibility to protect doctrine, you know, go in and hammer authoritarians. So that's really interesting. That's really significant, I think. And Amnesty, of course, has huge prestige both in the UK and around the world. So interesting development. Carry on.
Yeah, I mean, it's indicative of the huge chasm, really, between people who, like Amnesty, who cling to the post-war international law and civilian protections that were established under the general Never Again banner, and those like Britain and the United States, Germany for that matter, enthusiastically, for whom Never Again does not apply to Gaza. The State Department have been unable to answer the simple question, does the Geneva Convention apply to the citizens of Gaza? Tony Blinken himself literally running away from anybody who asks him that question. And the Spocks in the State Department briefing room just dodging the question entirely. The Amnesty report criticizes Israel's allies, and in a stark warning to world leaders, the organization said the world is reaping a harvest of terrifying consequences from escalating conflict and the near breakdown of international law. She added, in 2023, we were plunged back into a future we don't want, back to a future we were promised never again. 418 pages. And it points to the US's use of its veto to paralyze the UN Security Council for months by blocking the passage of the much needed resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, while continuing to arm Israel with weapons used to commit what may constitute war crimes. So, you know, the gloves are off, as it were. All this has been very obvious to any clear-thinking or lucid individual over the last several months. But unfortunately, we're now in a world where the governments of Britain and the United States simply disregard Amnesty. I mean, remember, Amnesty has been characterized by the Israelis as anti-Semitic for accurately describing the situation in historic Palestine.
I think it's an incredibly good sign that, I mean, it's seen as a Western organization, pro-Western organization, that liberal, much loved by Western intellectuals. And what we're seeing, I think, is the growth of, I don't know what you could call it, Western civil society or something that's not aligned with the foreign policy of those governments. So I think it's a very welcome sign, because we can't all this axis of authoritarianism. I mean, why don't they just call it an axis of evil? It's so sort of 2003, this kind of language. And it's I think it's incredibly encouraging, because as we in the West, we're going to survive as the West. We've got to transition and accept that we're going to have to live in a multipolar world and stop antagonizing everyone else with our arrogance, if you like. And I think that's part of Amnesty points the way to the future, I think. So that's a very, very encouraging
sign. I agree.
Sign.
I mean, they're far from perfect. But I mean, this report specifically condemns the United Kingdom for failing to use its leadership role within the UN as a permanent member of the Security Council to prevent human rights violations in Gaza, and its very weak support for the ICC investigation into human rights violations in Israel and Palestine. And it also highlights Britain's involvement in the arming of Israel. Of Israel itself, Deshmukh said, we've got a very deep concern about the UK's practice of supplying arms and significant components for arms. About 15% of finished F-35 warplanes are likely to contain UK parts or components. There is no doubt in my mind that the UK will be judged harshly by history for its failure to present prevent civilian slaughter in Gaza, she said.
Right, good. Okay, Basil, we'll have more news on the next hour, but we will go into our first guest now. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show. Talk to you soon, Basil, after the return of the next hour. Thanks.
I look forward to it.
TNT. Sonia Poulton.
If the British courts take the USA's poor application seriously and extradite Julian Assange, they will almost certainly have blood on their hands. Those are my words, not Stella's, although I know she thinks the same. She said so. The court has refused to address the very credible evidence that the CIA planned to kidnap and assassinate Julian Assange. We should all remember this moment the next time the UK or the USA dare to claim we are a free society while lecturing other countries about their lack of press freedoms. Julian Assange has been denied his freedom for 15 years. The entire process has been his punishment.
Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification. 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are opportunity zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Are we on the air?
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
On the air 24/7. Your news talk giant, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinero Taylor Show. We've got Jefferson Morley, who's an absolute legend in the JFK research community, and I can highly recommend that you look up his blog, JFK Facts, which I've often had opportunity to consult over the years. He's worked in Washington journalism for decades, 15 of which was spent as an editor and a reporter at the Washington Post. He's written 3 books on the topic of the deep state, I guess 4 if you include other topics. One is The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton, Our Man in Mexico, Winston Scott and the History of the CIA, and most recently, The Scorpion's Dance, The President, The Spymaster, and Watergate, which is about Nixon's relationship with Richard Helms, who was the head of the CIA, I think, in the early 70s. Now, welcome to the show, Jefferson.
Hi, Pelly. Thanks for having me.
I just want to begin with a quote of yours that you wrote. I haven't finished your book yet, but I will, because I'm a great fan of yours and of the topic of both JFK and and Watergate. But I'll start with the scene. You've got Richard Helms, then former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, talking in front of the 7 U.S. senators of the Watergate Committee back in the early 1970s. The CIA had no involvement in the break-in, he said. No involvement whatsoever. Helms emphasized with a broadside of rattling consonants, and it was my preoccupation consistently from then to this time to make this point and to be sure that everybody understands it. He clasped the microphone at its base. With the other hand, he chopped the table with his neatly aligned fingers. He surveyed the faces around him. I hope all the newsmen in the room hear me clearly now. And then the CBS News and ABC News reported him. And then you go on to make the point that, in fact, nearly everybody was involved in the CIA who was the break-in. Can you tell me a little bit about this disparity between Helms's claims and the actual facts? We'll start there.
Well, Richard Helms was really the consummate spy master. Smooth, friends everywhere in Washington, journalists, senators, anybody important. Dick Helms was friendly with them. And so the Watergate break-in, in which 6 of the 7 burglars had affiliations with the CIA, posed this immense problem for Helms. How could he disassociate? And so he puts on this bravura performance for the Senate Watergate Committee. And he prevails because what he is saying is so emphatically stated and yet completely false. It was Helms's ability to project this, how could you possibly disagree with me? You know, I'm an honorable man. And it really worked. With that performance, he really, you know, he was in deep trouble with the fact that the burglars were so associated with the CIA. And he really separates himself and enabled himself to escape the damage of the scandal that brought down his boss, the president of the United States.
I wonder how significant this is, because I've done a lot of reading on both Watergate and the JFK assassination. I've sort of settled. I was reading the Mark Lane book, which implicates Howard Hunt. And there's a witness called Marita Lawrence who says, you know, Hunt was in Dallas and handing out money to Frank Sturgis, Frank Fiorini. Yeah. And bloody hell, these guys pop up 10 years later. So the obvious question is, and there's rumors, you know, that Howard Hunt was in one of the photos at Dealey Plaza wearing a sort of looking like a spy. Not the three tramps, but another photo. And, you know, Mark Lane took him to the cleaners in this book. And then Howard Hunt was in 1972, he was part of this Plumhouse group. Can you tell us, do you think, is it significant that Howard Hunt was allegedly part of both plots, as it were? Or is this a red herring?
I mean, Hunt's involvement in the events of November 1963 is murky. What connects them is he was very well placed. He was very friendly with Dick Helms, something that was really never covered during the Watergate scandal. They had known each other since 1956, and we're not just professional colleagues, but we're personal friends. So Hunt was kind of this elite of the agency. And when Nixon wanted a burglar, wanted, you know, a team to carry out his dirty tricks against his enemies during the 1972 campaign, Helms very thoughtfully makes available Hunt, who's one of his top men. And Helms also knew that Hunt was actually rather right-wing for the CIA, but he knew he would get along with Nixon. They had similar politics. So Helms kind of matches Hunt to Nixon's interests. And he does that because this is a guy who he's been relying on for these types of subterranean, off the books, dirty tricks, you know, for his whole career. So, you know, was Hunt involved in the assassination of President Kennedy? He made some comments at the end of his life in which he implicates the agency. And that's not something Howard Hunt would normally do. He was a total CIA loyalist. So the fact that he would make statements, you know, it's an admission against interest, surprising. Mm. And to me, it's telling. I think that whether he was involved or not, he knew that the president had been attacked by his enemies, you know, in the CIA. And I think Hunt knew that, and Helms knew that.
Because that was like a deathbed confession, or almost deathbed confession, to his wayward son. And then,
The problem with that, he wasn't on his deathbed. He said it 2 years before he died. And he also said a lot of contradictory things in that interview. Mm-hmm. And Howard was a bit of a scoundrel. You know, he's not a trustworthy person. And so, you know, yes, he said some things that were very incriminating, but he also said some things that were, you know, total denials. So that interview it's hard to lean on it as evidence, except in a kind of general.
And what about that, the Mark Lane implication with Marita Lawrence, or whatever her name is,
Marita Lawrence was friends with Frank Sturgis and Hunt. That's indisputable. The story that she tells about them going to Dallas in November 1963 is not corroborated, but she's a credible witness. And to me, the greatest thing that added to her credibility was in 1976 or 1977, she was going to be called before the Congress to, you know, to tell her story. And Frank Sturgis comes to kill her. And so, you know, and it was only the fact that Lorenz's teenage daughter grabbed a gun and was going to kill Sturgis and got arrested that it didn't happen. So why would Sturgis want to kill her unless, you know, he was very threatened by what she had to say.
We're going to get after the break. Although I wish these interviews were longer, but I'm not going to cite the exact books because it's like I've read so much on Watergate. Yeah. But after the break, we're going to talk about. I mean, how worried was the American deep state about what Nixon and Kissinger were doing? Because here they were flying off to Peking and Moscow, and we know that the Pentagon had infiltrated one of their assets. Sergeant Moore reading Kissinger's burn bag, and I want to know if the CIA wanted to keep tabs on Nixon and whether Hunt they were going to ready to sabotage Nixon's Dirty Tricks campaign in the hope that it would implicate Nixon. But we're going to come back to that after a break for the news. Okay, this is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show, and we've got Jefferson Morley with us, but we'll talk more after a quick news break.
TNT Radio News.
Huge news, 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 news.
Matt Boylan here with your TNT headlines. The war on censorship has intensified in Australia, where ex-boss Elon Musk has vowed to fight for the rights of the country's citizens. Meanwhile, the public feud has propelled X to the top of the charts to become the most downloaded news app in Australia as more people there turn to the site for the truth. And there's anger brewing in America after a Republican was ordered to delete a video of his X account showing Democrats waving Ukrainian flags in the halls of Congress.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
We've got with us Jefferson Morley, one of the top Kennedy writers, and now he's also written a book about Watergate and two of the leading figures there, Nixon himself and the spy master, Richard Helms. I just want to ask, Hunt, I want to ask whether that he was a kind of a plant. The whole Plumbers team were used. I can't cite the book, but Hunt was sometimes called the Immaculate Incompetence. So everything he did before Watergate had some kind of self-sabotaging element. So when they broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist studio, whatever, his office, they made it really obvious and they screwed it up. Can you? What do you think? Hunt was a part of a CIA sabotage? Political sabotage, you know, self-sabotage team.
The incompetence of the burglars is striking, but I don't think that they intentionally sabotaged the burglary. Because if you look at what happened immediately after their arrest, Hunt went home, threw his typewriter in a pond. McCord, who was in jail, called his wife and ordered her to burn all of his files at home. Created a big smoky fire, was the talk of the neighborhood. Hunt went on the lam. He was a fugitive for a couple of months. None of that could have been planned. So to me, the response of the burglars to getting arrested indicates that this was not intentionally sabotaged. Now, when Richard Helms provided Hunt's services to the White House, he understood that that gave him a channel of intelligence into the White House, which is something that he wanted. You know, Helms had a problem, which was he had trouble getting to President Nixon because Nixon was guarded so carefully, both by Bob Haldeman, the chief of staff, and Henry Kissinger. And so, you know, Helms had to work to get in to see Nixon, which is something that he always wanted. So Helms was looking for, you know, ways to know about what was going on in the White House. But sabotage, I don't think that's what happened.
Right. And so you don't think, I just want to say, because Haldeman's memoirs, and he was a very sort of pedantic guy, I think he seemed to think that the whole thing was a CIA operation. And that when Nixon talked about the Bay of Pigs thing, with Helms, and that was the thing he was done for in the obstruction of justice case. He was kind of blackmailing Helms into saying, "Well, I know that the CIA did Kennedy, so if you don't get the FBI to lay off me, I'm going to expose that." Yeah. And Helms said, "Well, okay, well, I'm going to get you first."
That's definitely true. When Haldeman said that when Nixon used this term, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, that was a kind of coded reference to JFK's assassination. And Haldeman is correct, and I show that in my book, Scorpion's Dance. 8 months earlier, Helms and Nixon had a conversation in which Nixon was pressuring Helms to give him information about the Bay of Pigs. And Helms refused to give it to him and said, what's this about? Why do you have to know this? And Nixon says, and you can hear him on the Watergate tape, and I was the first person to report this in my book, Nixon says, the who shot John angle. That is clearly a reference to JFK's assassination. And it shows that Haldeman was right. When Nixon talked about the whole Bay of Pigs thing, that was a way of referring to Kennedy's assassination. So after the burglars get arrested, Nixon sends Haldeman to go see Helms. And he says, tell him, if he doesn't cooperate with us, if he doesn't play ball with us, it could blow the whole Bay of Pigs thing. Helms understood very clearly that he was being blackmailed. He blew up. And it is at that point that the interests of Richard Helms and Richard Nixon diverge. Now, I don't think that Helms turned around and said, I'm going to get rid of Nixon. Helms really liked Nixon. Helms was a hardline anti-communist guy. He did not want to get rid of Richard Nixon. Other people in the CIA, maybe. Other people in the Pentagon, maybe. But not Dick Helms. Liked and admired Nixon and was glad to serve under him. But at that point, he understood, if he's going to blackmail me, I'm going to protect myself and my agency, and I'm not going to protect him. And so he kind of left Nixon twist in the wind, and Nixon eventually falls.
I just want to, we'll get back to that, just follow up that thread, because this guy McCord, who was some kind of head of security for the CIA, so obviously a very competent, you know, break-in or technical man, and he was the guy who flubbed the whole. He wrote a book called The Piece of Tape, which is because he didn't tape back. He did tape back the lock. So when the security guard came around, they said, oh, there is a break-in going on. Anyway, McCord was in jail in January 73, and he said something. He wrote, I'm going to blow up the whole thing, or something like that. You know, I'm going, if the CIA gets involved, everything is going to blow. And that was when he started talking to the judge Sirica, and that sort of was the beginning of the end for Nixon. Was that because he felt that Nixon was taking on the CIA now, and McCord needed to protect the CIA?
Absolutely. And as I show in Scorpion's Dance, McCord had a back channel to Helms during that time, and McCord at first was silent, wasn't going to say anything about it, but as Helms and McCord saw where things were going, McCord goes public and he dumps the whole thing on the White House, saying the CIA had nothing to do with this. This was all the White House's doing, which was not true, but that was the line that McCord and Helms wanted out there. We had nothing to do with this. Our guys were retired long ago. We didn't know anything about that. None of that was true, but they really put the onus on Nixon. And so when McCord goes to Judge Sirica and says, look, yes, we've been pressured. You know, this goes to the highest levels of the White House. That was sensational news and true in a way, partially true, but it obscured how much it was a joint White House CIA venture.
But I mean, did Helms have anything to do with McCord's revelations? Did he say, well, you know, did he think, oh, well, Nixon's after me now. He's after the CIA. He's going to talk about John and all that. Did any messages pass between them, him and McCord, who was in jail and in the position to blow the whistle or explode or whatever and destroy Nixon?
Between June 72, when McCord was arrested, and January 73, when he goes on trial, and then March 73, when he goes public, Helms and McCord sent Helms four different letters at the CIA. So I believe that they were coordinating their testimony, and they had been friends and colleagues for a long time. After McCord retired, in his office, he had an autographed picture of Helms on the wall of his office, and it said, Jim, thanks for everything. Underlined, yours, Dick Helms. When McCord was arrested and he told his wife to burn his files, the other thing he told his wife to do was go to the office and take that picture down. So McCord understood that he had to obscure his connection to Helms right from the start.
Jefferson, I'm very sorry that we have to wind up there. These interviews are so short. I wish we could, but I'll sort of wind up. I said, I can highly recommend Jefferson Morley's a top Kennedy writer and now also a top Watergate writer. The Scorpion's Dance is about the president and his spy master and how they fell out. And I can highly recommend it because the official Watergate story, just say, because when I was a young journalist student in the UK, I wanted to be like Robert Redford and all the president's men, you know, and I wanted to write for the Washington Post, which you did.
Yeah.
Forget the Times or the Guardian. It was the Washington Post, you know. And so I've always been interested in Watergate because I wanted to sit there at a typewriter and bash things out. Just a few sentences or a minute or 30 seconds. What do you want the average Europeans' takeaway message from your book? Because we have this a very official view of Watergate. What would you like to bring to our to the public's knowledge of the real Watergate or the real whole thing?
The public understanding of Watergate has really been shaped by the movie All the President's Men. And with all credit to Woodward and Bernstein, they really missed a big part of the story, which was the CIA connection. And it was not known at the time. Over the years, a lot has come out, and I used that material in my book to present a much fuller picture that Watergate really was a joint venture of the CIA and the White House. It was not Nixon off on his own. It was Nixon empowered by Richard Helms.
Mm. Mm. Okay. Jefferson Morley, editor of JFK Facts, the blog about JFK assassination, and author of Scorpion's Dance. You can find all the usual places. Thank you very much, Jefferson. Sorry we had to leave you so early. Thanks a lot. This is the Pelle Nerols Taylor Show. Off to the next guest now. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Susan Lucci. I never thought about heart disease until I had my own heart event. At first, like so many other women out there, I ignored my symptoms. A slight pressure on my chest, shortness of breath. I thought, I don't have time to be sick. I had a 90% blockage in my main artery and a 75% blockage in the adjacent artery. I received two stents in my arteries. Stents developed through research funded by the American Heart Association. Those stents saved my life. I'm so grateful to the American Heart Association. Their research helped save my life. I can enjoy life with my children, my grandchildren, and my friends. Please, listen to your heart. The only reason I'm here today is because I did. Learn more about the American Heart Association's life-saving work at helpheart.org.
I know kids worry about a lot of things. Getting enough food to eat shouldn't be one of them. Through a nationwide network of food banks, Feeding America serves virtually every community in the United States. See how you can help your community. Visit feedingamerica.org.
Last week, Brandon met a girl on a dating app. One day after work, he finally found the courage to ask her out. No answer. He started to panic. Was he being too pushy? Maybe it was too...
Hey, sorry I didn't respond. I was driving. I would love to go on a date. How does tonight sound?
Brandon tried to play it cool, but inside he knew. A girl so smart, so responsible. She must be a keeper.
First dinner time for dinner.
Donating pet food can keep families together. Pets and people belong together. Learn more at petsandpeopletogether.org.
Geopolitical commentator and investigative journalist, you're listening to Pelle Neuroth Taylor on today's News Talk.
TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neuroth Taylor Show. We've got the returning guest, very welcome, here to Trevor Fitzgibbon, who's a strategist who's primarily focused on defending human rights whistleblowers and exposing corruption. He's worked with journalist George Eliason and filmmaker Igor Lopatonok, who's exposed information operation and all the propaganda surrounding the war in Ukraine. And of course, very engaged in the Assange case, which leads us to a very interesting segue here, because the previous guest, we talked about Watergate, and Ellsberg is very much part of that. Welcome to the show, Trevor. Do you remember?
Hey, thank you so much. Perhaps? Thank you for having me.
We were talking about we were talking about the Watergate scandal, and one of the main things about Watergate, or the run up to Watergate, was Daniel Ellsberg, and he was alive for a long time after that, and he was also involved in the Assange case, and comparisons have been drawn between the relative leniency towards Ellsberg, who was one of the reasons Nixon tried to get at Ellsberg, because he was spilling secrets about the Vietnam War, but he walked off scot-free, didn't he? And Assange, who is also And it, he wasn't even an insider. I mean, Ellsberg was an insider, whereas Chelsea Manning is sort of the insider, and she went to jail. And Assange, who's the New York Times of it, as it were, who's the publisher, the newsman, also went to jail. Whereas the New York Times back in the early 70s, no one could imagine putting them in jail. So could you draw some parallels there? I mean, is free speech, do we have less free speech now than in the Nixon era?
Well, I think one of the things you definitely have, back then there was more outrage with the general public in regards to nefarious government tactics. And, you know, that's why, you know, Ellsberg did not go to prison, is because the government was found to have, you know, illegal actions done to set Ellsberg up. And the people that did this to Ellsberg were also the same people later on responsible for Watergate. And so there was a lot of pressure put on Nixon, because they were also his tapes. There's a lot of pressure put on Nixon to free, you know, Ellsberg, as opposed to today, where, you know, you have an administration that's literally just unaccountable to anything or anyone, where, you know, we have in the Southern District of New York, you know, four people. You have two American journalists and two attorneys, some of whom have worked with Julian in the past. They are suing the CIA for violating their Fourth Amendment constitutional protections, because whenever they would go and meet with Julian inside of the Ecuadorian embassy, we've now discovered through the case out of Spain that the CIA and via UC Global, the Spanish security firm, was not only surveilling those meetings inside between Julian's American attorneys and American journalists. They weren't just surveilling those conversations, but they were actually taking the laptops and the cell phones, and they were wiping them of all data and sending it straight back to the CIA. That's above and beyond what would normally one, as the judge would say, one would expect. You know, if you're going to meet with Assange, the federal judge has said you can anticipate you're likely going to be surveilled, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, is ridiculous also, because that's a violation of international asylum law. Mm-hmm. But I think this administration really doesn't care. You know, one would think they wouldn't want a big fight like this, extradition of Julian, the First Amendment case in an election year. But I just don't think they care. I think they want to do whatever they want to do.
So they actually wiped the information. They took all the information and surveilled it, basically, of all the journalists visiting. I mean, that's, I didn't know that, and that really does go beyond. I mean, we would sort of expect, well, they'll have the security cameras on, and they maybe listen to that conversation. I think the journalist would expect that, but to what you're saying is really heavy duty. And of course, these journalists will have their contacts, and they'll have all their articles and lots of private information there. So, carry on.
If I could just say, and it's not just them, right? I mean, Lord knows how many private email conversations that these attorneys had with clients back in the US who have nothing to do with Julian, or were not part of any targeted, they weren't targeted, they weren't part of any investigation. And now all of those attorney client privilege emails on clients has nothing to do with this case. They're sitting in the hands of the CIA. So in essence, it's not just a constitutional crisis when it comes to those who went and met with Assange, but also for all of that information that the CIA now has at their disposal, in their hands. The other thing is William Burns just did this under the state's declaration of the state secrets privilege. And, you know, in that situation, when they invoke the state secrets privilege, the director of the CIA communicates with the judge, but we're not allowed to see it. Julian's, the attorneys aren't allowed to see what it is, you know, what it is that they've given to the judge. So we have 30 days to respond to something that we don't know what it is, but we have 30 days to respond to this. And then the judge will make the decision as to whether or not he's going to grant the CIA state secrets privilege.
So basically, just to summarize, trust us, bro, basically, the CIA is sort of kind of saying that, and you're not allowed to contest that, which basic principles of justice says everything has to be in the open so you can contest it and object to the other side's arguments. And you don't know if the judge is a kind of bought guy or something. You probably never say that. Well, just we'll talk a little bit about what new legislation going through the United States Senate, and which Edward Snowden has severely criticized as extending the surveillance state. But just 1 or 2 minutes about the latest on Assange, because not everybody watches everything. I thought it was looked quite optimistic, but that the Americans, when the British said, well, you know, the Americans have to comply with these requirements before we extradite him. But it seems that Americans are sort of complying with it, and they might indeed push ahead for this extradition to happen. What are your thoughts on that?
It's going to be interesting to see what happens. As I understand it, based on interviews that Julian Assange's wife, Stella Assange, has given, what the U.S. did provide is they're allowing Julian to seek extradition. But they're not giving. I mean, they're allowing Julian Assange to seek First Amendment protections, but they're not necessarily giving him First Amendment protections. And as I understand it, that's a violation of the extradition treaty. That the extradition treaty says we're not going to send somebody over there unless they're guaranteed First Amendment protections. And so I don't know if the UK court is going to buy this wordplay that it would appear that the Department of Justice attorneys are putting forward, that Julian is allowed to seek First Amendment protections. And so that's a big deal, you know, because it's also a big deal. I mean, who knows if he comes over here and then the U.S. decides to tack on more charges like aiding the enemy. I don't know if there has been any guarantee against that. We'll see what happens.
What do the Americans really want? I mean, are they setting up their own thing to fail by inserting this clause that could give the Europeans or the Brits a get out? Or do they really want him over? What do you think?
You know, I don't know. There's so many information ops going on right now and disinformation. I don't know. I remember when somebody asked President Biden whether or not the U.S. was going to listen to Australia's appeal to have him return to Australia. I think Biden said, we're thinking about it. And that gave a lot of people hope. I don't know if President Biden knows what day it is. You know, I really don't. Right. And a lot of this stuff has happened under his watch. I think it's going to be difficult to get Democrats mobilized over here in the United States against Biden, because nothing's viewed through the lens of principles anymore. Everything is viewed through partisan hacks, and the principles seem to have been lost.
Trevor, what's the next date then we should look out for on the Assange case, where next decision point?
May 20th.
Okay.
It's my brother's birthday, and that is also the day that the UK court is going to make their decision, I believe at 8 in the morning or 8:30 a.m. UK time at the High Court. It's a big day, and we encourage everybody, you know, first of all, if you can support the Defend Assange campaign, please do financially, but also take action. Call your member of Congress. There's legislation out there, and there are a number of ways you can get involved by going to the WikiLeaks website or the WikiLeaks Twitter account.
Okay. We're just going to pivot over to this NSA legislation that's going through. I want to quote a guy called James Bamford, who wrote a brilliant book about the National Security Agency about 20 years ago. And he wrote an article recently in The Nation where he says, 2024 seems the appropriate year for the passage of the most oppressive piece of surveillance legislation in U.S. history. It's the 40th anniversary of the surveillance state that George Orwell wrote about in his prescient novel 1984. Any sound that Winston made above the level of a very low whisper would be picked up by it, he wrote. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment. You had to live and live from a habit that became instinct in the assumption that every sound you made would be overheard. And except in darkness, every movement scrutinized. So that's James Bamford writing about this legislation. Can you just give us more detail about that, and how oppressive is it?
I would listen to the technical experts, folks over at the ACLU and others who fought this. But, based on what I understand, this provides major American companies, corporations, it allows the intelligence community access with all of these major corporations and all of their customers into their customers' private information. And I think you know, the scariest thing it does is you no longer need a FISA warrant in order to surveil anybody. So it just allows for that carte blanche. So it would appear that that under both the Obama administration and now the Biden administration, we have regressed when it comes to all of the incredible work that Edward Snowden did, Glenn and Laura Poitras and everybody who worked on that. It's sad to see we've regressed.
What is the difference between having a FISA warrant and not having a FISA warrant? And what categories of people have been and will be surveilled? You just you only need to talk in very broad brush terms because people here in Europe don't know a thing about it, you know?
Everyone can be surveilled now without a FISA warrant. As I understand it, everyone. It has opened up the door for everyone.
So basically, anyone can do anything inside the intelligence community can do anything. And was the FISA warrant effective at all? At least it provided kind of moral barrier, or at least it was something. And now that's been swept away. I mean, did it?
But it was actually always a sham. I mean, whenever you know, the intelligence community would put forward, hand over all the warrants that they would want, you know, through FISA, I think FISA rubber stamped almost every single one. I don't know if FISA's ever not given the intelligence community what they want. This is almost just like they're so lazy they don't even want to apply for it, right? So you know, it was unconstitutional to begin with because it was not enforced, right? But now it's just kind of green lit. And so
I'm reading some of the articles, some of the technical stuff that you're referring to, and it basically seems to be that the American state is going to be able to do the sort of things that already took place in the court case when American journalists were swept when they went into the Ecuadorian embassy. In other words, every single, journalists communicating with foreign sources and attorneys discussing cases with clients and potential witnesses, well, they'll be put off by this because, so nobody's going to want to approach a journalist again because it's going to be spied on, and clients are not going to talk to their attorneys because, again, it could be spied on. And that sounds like exactly the sort of thing that was happening in the Julian Assange case when they were swept by going into the embassy. But basically, this is terrible because we're going to have, it's going to mean the death of journalism. Basically, this I don't know if you could talk. I mean, I don't want to be too hyperbolic because people have often talked about the death of journalism. But I mean, if this really means that people are going to speak less to confidential sources, then that's really bad, you know.
Yeah, it's horrific. I mean, you know, the state of journalism in around the world, but specifically in the West, I think it's really, really regressed. And you know, the notion of objectivity is gone as it is. And so you had very few journalists in the U.S. really stepping up and defending Assange again, because I just don't think that they get it. No one can seem to look beyond the partisan lenses that they've got. And Donald Trump says things that are so egregious at times that's what the journalists and mainstream media gets all caught up with. And when you that's compounded with, you know, information ops and propaganda from the feds in regards to Julian and what a horrible person he is, where he's really not, right? He's a truth teller and he's a hero. He's a global hero and he's a publisher. And so, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it one more time. You know, if the U.S. can prosecute a foreign publisher, a foreign journalist for publishing factual documents, then no journalist is safe, not in the U.S. and certainly not internationally.
I think that bears repetition because people are so obscured by Julian Assange's personal character, the allegations made against him, and the whole backstory about the sort of the Swedish rape cases and so on. And he's been so smeared by not least the New York Times and so on, that they can't look at the principles that stand behind it, which could pave the way for worldwide persecution of journalists. And I'm very glad that you're front-ending that and putting it forward. We've only got 30 seconds left or so, but could you just tell us, do you think you worked on Ukraine as well? Do you think it's this, we're moving towards a multipolar world, you've got two centers. Is it because we're moving towards the end of American hegemony, that these laws are tightening up. Is the administration afraid?
Yeah. Yes. That's what it is.
Yeah, exactly. So at the end of Empire, like a dying beast thrashes around and harms a lot of people around it. That's maybe where we stand at the moment. Anyway, Trevor Fitzgibbon, thank you very much for your presence. You're an Assange expert and strategist, and you focused on human rights whistleblowers, and we'll have you on again maybe after May the 20th. Thank you very much. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show, and we're going into our next guest after a news break and a sweeper.